Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. We have three panelists here tonight to discuss living in the material world. And I'd like to welcome our live audience and our audiences online and on the radio. Our discussion is one of a series that we've done on this topic with the Humanities Forum. Our interest is very simple. Obviously, we have been very, very successful materially in the last couple hundred years. We've figured out all kinds of things. It's made our lives much more comfortable, physically comfortable, you know, but has it made our minds more comfortable? Well, you can say it has to have in some ways. And it's very interesting, I think, to anybody in the humanities who also pays attention to the other things that are going on, that something like the expansion of the middle class in India and China in the last 20, 30 years, which has added hundreds of millions of people to a state where they're not worried about their next meal and so on and so forth, so that they're not living lives from one moment to the other wondering, you know, are they going to be able to survive, survival mode. And, of course, you kind of have to have that survival stuff done before you have time for something else. And what is society going to do by not having slavery? I mean, slavery was the solution before. It allowed some class to be able to think about things while everybody else was doing work, and nobody really, I think, wants to go back. Not nobody, but most people do not want to go back to that system. And there's always some group that wants to go back to whatever was done before. But we're trying to move in a direction where everybody is an individual and accepted as an individual, and yet there's time for things besides just surviving. So living in the material world is sort of an overall, and of course we borrowed it from the documentary about George Harrison that was done. But it's a decision we don't really make ourselves. We're here, whether we want to be or not. So the question is, how do you make the most of it, and how do you take the humanities and make the most of it? And one of the things that we often discuss in that process is a lot of people focus their reformist zeal and reformist energy on trying to make the world a better place in terms of trying to create some kind of order in the way that people live their lives. You can only do this. You have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and not at noon because all those kind of external rules that are there to try to create some kind of order, whereas the order in life, I mean, people, you know, not everybody fits into every box that's created. And that desire for order, of course, is almost as oppressive to the humanities as the disorder that's around us. And I think one of the things that's very useful is to look back at all the great achievements of the human race, the ones that we keep in order to keep reminding ourselves we do something other than just survive. So we hold on to ancient architecture. We hold on to ancient books. If I have my Leonardo tie on today, but if there were 1,000 Leonardos in every generation, we wouldn't be talking about him anymore, because everybody would have surpassed his things and so on. It's the fact that not enough people live like that, that we hold on to every bit and say, "See, he's human too," just the way, you know, a boy who's learned to play baseball, you know, says, "See, you know, I'm just like Babe Ruth." I mean, that was a long time ago, but I play baseball just like him. I play baseball just like that star. It's that identification with the stars that makes us feel our humanity is extremely valuable. So the question is, in the 21st century, with the digital and material solutions to all kinds of things, a lot of arts have been invaded by this digital revolution, and it has made it very interesting. If you went back 150 years and you were a musician, for example, a local musician, well, everybody would enjoy your music on a Saturday night. This was all before television and everything. And, you know, on a Saturday night in the summer, there would be these concerts, and, you know, they probably weren't great musicians, but everybody had a good time with them. Now that everybody can hear, now with just a button pushed, they can hear the best musicians in the whole world, the local musicians are all told you're not that good. You're not perfect. And so it's very hard to go from being an amateur that's still entertaining to a professional that can earn a living at these things. And there's a huge number of people who want to do this, and most people don't succeed. I worked in a law firm in New York, and it was filled with people in night steno and secretarial staff and cleaning who were all there either in New York to be actors or musicians or comedians or anything that draws people to New York or Los Angeles, the same sort of thing. So I think one of the decisions about this is how do we incorporate art into our lives? We make earn our living a certain way, and we incorporate art into life another way. We make it an important part, we make it a hobby, or we make it a profession, depending upon our level of skill and our financial resources. So, but the crucial thing, of course, is how expressing ourselves individually in art, music, whatever art you pick, or several arts, or in business, creating a business, making something so that 100 people can make their living off of what you do, is also a form of art and a form of expression of yourself. And so how do we make those decisions in order to feel that our lives are humane and human rather than just back to survival even though we're rich? Because it would seem pretty weak if you just said, what did you do during your life? You said, well, I watched 10,000 movies and I watched 100,000 music videos and, et cetera, et cetera. Even in those things, if you watch them with somebody else, at least you're doing it with somebody else. So there's some joint experiences. But not too many people would want to say that's their epitaph, you know, what they accomplished, what they consumed. I consumed so many potatoes and so on. So that's our approach. How do we live a humane life in the material world? We have great panelists this time. Right here is Russ Hancock. Russ Hancock is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and he is also in charge of or one of the members of St. Michael's Trio, which performs music and is a very, very highly regarded group here in the Bay Area and outside the Bay Area. We have Carolyn Winter here from the Stanford Humanities Center, and we have Judy Salter here from, they just changed the name again, Judy?
California Humanities Council.
The California Humanities Council, and which she's on the board of directors. And she has a very interesting resume of what she's done herself, but right now she's on the board, so she's representing that institution. And we're going to have them talk about their own lives and how they've done this, but also about their institutions to the extent that that's a relevant choice on their part. And we're going to start with Carolyn Winter from the Stanford Humanities Center. And when everyone has talked, which should be about a half an hour from now, we'll take Q&A from everybody else. So go ahead, Carolyn.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come here tonight. It's a real pleasure to be here and to talk about a topic that's very near and dear to my heart, which is about the place of the humanities in the world today. As you've heard, I'm the director of the Stanford Humanities Center, which is one of the two largest humanities centers in the world. And it's right here, near you, down on the Stanford campus. We run about 50 public events a year. So we hope to see you coming to them. If you would like to do so, there's a stack of bookmarks in the back of the room for you to pick up if you would like to. Before I became director of the Humanities Center, I was also a professor of history at Stanford, specifically a historian of early America and the history of ideas. I'm still also a history professor, but I spend a lot of my time doing administration now. But as with so many things that I do in life, I approach questions such as the one that's before us today historically. And I find that I often get a lot of wisdom from looking at how things were done in the past and how the question that is before us today was understood and answered in the past. So I'm going to put my historian's hat on for a moment and to talk to you about how it is that the interplay between the material world and the study of the humanities and the arts has been understood in the past. And I think it can very much inform how we approach that question today. And I would say that the most important thing is that we often perceive a conflict today between the humanities and the material world. And we believe that there is somehow some sort of opposition between the two. And what I'm here to tell you is that this is, in fact, a historically constructed opposition, that, in fact, that there is no necessary opposition between the study of the humanities for the sheer pleasure of learning. All of those of you who were English majors or art history majors, you probably studied these disciplines for the sheer pleasure of doing so. And we hear often in the university today that somehow they don't prepare you for a career. But this is all a very, very new way of thinking about the humanities, and I'm going to tell you the origin in just a minute. Because it is historically constructed, it can also be deconstructed. We used to think about things in a different way, and we can begin to think about them in a different way again today. So what's the origin of this? Well, as many of you know, universities are very, very old. They come to us from the Middle Ages. Now, if you'd gone to a medieval university, most of the subjects that are taught in today's university would not be there. Mostly, you would have spent a lot of your time, in fact, about 99% of your time, studying three things. You would have studied Greek, Latin, and theology. Now, why did you do these things? Well, because a lot of life in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and the early modern period was about the glorification of God in a world that was very theocentric. But it was also very important to learn Greek and Latin, because Greek and Latin were not only the languages of theology, the languages of the Bible, but they were also the languages of civic engagement. You learned Greek and Latin because they were extremely practical skills. You learned Greek and Latin to be a wonderful thinker so that you could go into the Senate and think about how things had been done in the past so that you could chart an intelligent path to how things should be done in the future. You learned Latin rhetoric so that you could speak in a clear and informed and persuasive way to your listeners in the age before there was any kind of recorded speech as there is today. So when you learned Greek and Latin in the universities, you were learning eminently practical, useful skills that were going to prepare you for civic life, and, this is an important and, that were going to help to earn you a decent living wage. So they were not impractical. They were very practical. What happened in the 19th century was that the function of the university utterly changed. And it began to be believed that instead of having a preservative function and a civic preparation function, universities should be preparing people for practical jobs. So this is when we see the universities beginning to include subjects like biology, like engineering, like medicine. And these were explicitly advertised as being preparation for future jobs. They had a very practical component. The humanists responded to this with a new argument. And what they said was, okay, we get that bridge building is very important. We get that learning how to build a locomotive is very important. So what is our value added now in a world in which Greek and Latin is no longer as explicitly useful? They are no longer the language of theology and scholarship. The argument they made was this. What we offer is higher than practicality. We are above the merely practical. We offer a kind of spiritual regeneration for all of you within the university. So you can go ahead and learn to build roads, build railroads, cure cancer, all of those things. We are going to offer you something higher than mere utility. Now, I really want to draw your attention to that argument, because on the one hand, it was a brilliant argument, right? You're justifying a series of disciplines that could have just been entirely abandoned from the university. But that argument came at a price, and the price was that the humanists abandoned the idea that what they could teach was practical and useful for the future citizens of the world. And that is where I think that humanists can begin to reclaim the conversation of vocationalism and utility. Of course, we offer something higher than mere vocation and utility. It's really great to study literature and art for the mere sake of studying those extremely humanizing disciplines. We learn to come into contact with minds that came before us and minds from very distant parts of the world. That is an extremely important and, in some senses, deeply impractical pursuit. But we should also remember, and we should also very publicly remind people that what the humanities offer within the universities is of enormous public practicality, utility, and value in the world today for so many of the problems that confront us around the world. We need people who understand different cultures, who understand different ways of life, who understand different religions, who can speak different languages, who understand the music and the art of other places and times. This is the work of the humanities, and we should be very, very clear about telling our students that what we are giving them in these studies is not just a ticket to the past world of art and literature, but a ticket to the future world of becoming successful citizens, deeply engaged citizens, as we go forward in the world together. Thank you.
And now we'll hear from Russ Hancock about how he does it in his own life.
Oh. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for this invitation. I'm here to share my life experience, and hopefully it's of use or of an interest. I'm happy to talk about these things. It's certainly one of my favorite subjects. The subject is how do you have a career in the arts and balance that with a career somewhere else. And that is, in fact, what I'm doing. So just let me tell you my story. I am the president and CEO of an organization called Joint Venture Silicon Valley. It also houses the Silicon Valley Institute for Regional Studies. I'm the president of that. My field is public policy. I have a PhD in the subject from Stanford, actually, and I continue to teach at Stanford. I have an appointment in the public policy program, and I teach all of the classes on local and state government and regional politics and decision making. So this is what I do. I also lead a parallel life as a concert pianist, and I do have a thriving performing career. I appear with symphony orchestras throughout the country. I'm under management, and I absolutely thrive on being on stage, making music, getting music in front of people and into their ears, and having all of the joy that's associated with art. Now, I am also, as was mentioned, the founder of the St. Michael Trio. I play with a violinist, and I play with a cellist, and we have recorded several albums. We are also under management. We appear at Stanford many times throughout the year in Dinkle-Spiel Auditorium. We also have been appointed the artist in residence at Montalvo Arts Center in Saratoga. Come see us there. We'd love to have your visit. It's a wonderful place to take in music. And so the St. Michael Trio is enjoying this thriving enterprise of making music. And let me tell you just a word about the trio and its mission. It's to make chamber music fresh and accessible to new generations of listeners. And so we actually take all of the revenue that we generate through our performances, and we have put it into the St. Michael Foundation. And we actually don't realize any of that income ourselves. All three of us, by the way, lead parallel lives with other professions. The violinist is a doctor. The cellist is a software architect. So anyway, we take all of the money, we put it into this foundation, and the purpose of the foundation is music education. It's reaching young people in the rising generation, engaging them in chamber music, and it's to commission the great composers of our day, so that we're not merely playing the music of dead composers all of the time. And so we've done a great deal of commissioning. Let me tell you one other thing that has become our trademark. We're passionately committed to making our performances informative. We found that it's just not very fun, satisfying to take the stage, dump the music on the audience, and leave. What's far more interesting and compelling to us is to have an interactive experience with our audiences and to talk about the music. So we have actually coined a word for this. We call these informances, not performances, but informances. And we actually will take a composer and we'll go greatly in depth. We'll show slides. We'll show demonstrations of the compositional devices. We'll talk about the composer's life and times. We'll talk about the influences that were upon him or her and show how those things were manifest in the music. We'll talk about the music in the context of what came before. And then how it was used as a platform for the music that came after, the breakthroughs, the development, what was innovative about this particular composer. And we love demonstrating these things. So we will actually talk as much as we will perform the music. And this has been absolutely wonderful. So that's the story. When I was young, my mother taught me. She is my piano teacher. And I started at 4 years of age. And I absolutely love to play. When I was in school, I was also interested in other things. I never had this sense that I needed to be limited to one thing or to the other. I always had this sense that life could be, it could have a multiplicity of interests and that it was possible to pursue them both. Now, sure enough, you'll get to a point where you actually have to declare a major. And so I came to that fateful place. And for me, I was deciding if I should go to the music conservatory or if I should just enroll in a liberal arts college. I was admitted to Harvard. I decided to go there, and I decided to that was a fateful choice because Harvard is a great place to pursue music, but you can't actually major in it. They don't have a performance major. So I went to Harvard, and the understanding was that I would continue to be musical, I would continue to perform, but I would also major in government, economics, and public policy, and that I would pursue a life of both. And so the term that I always use is parallel. I don't consider myself an amateur musician, although I love amateurism and the concept of amateurism. I believe in it, but I don't consider myself an amateur. I consider myself a professional musician. And by the way, when we present ourselves in the St. Michael Trio, we never make a thing about how we're doing this in a parallel track and that we have day jobs. We just never talk about that. We want to present ourselves to the music establishment as concert artists, and we want to be judged according to those terms. So this is what we're doing. It really is living a parallel life and finding ways to express in both of these. Now, perhaps you'll be interested to ask questions about, you know, how we actually do this and how we make it practical. And I'll be happy to go into any of that. But I'll finally just tell you that the music happens because I can't help it. I just cannot help it. It comes out of me and my colleagues uncontrollably. And isn't that perfectly wonderful? Isn't it wonderful that you know, we've been given metabolism and we can pursue all of these different things? Finally, I'll just say that if you're interested, it'll be very fun to talk about how my professional life in public policy and business informs my musical life and vice versa. If that's a subject of interest, then by all means, let's go there. But I feel like I've said enough. I'm anxious to hear from the final member of our panel.
I don't think I've heard a shorter version of saying living in the material world other than making use of your metabolism to follow your passions. That's just perfect. Okay, glad you.
That's terrific. It's an honor to be with both of you all on the panel tonight. I'm from Redding, California, and I drove down here today. So I come from a very different perspective from a very rural part of our state. We consider ourselves the other California. Most people think Northern California sort of stops somewhere between here and Sacramento. And after that, we're just kind of a blur. But I appreciate that. We're the other California, mountains, lakes, beautiful rivers. Come visit us. I was the president of, I'm retired as the president of a wonderful museum up there. It's a 300-acre cultural campus, which includes galleries, arboretum, aquaria, botanical gardens. Come see us. It's worth the drive. But I'm here today actually because I'm a board member of the California Council on the Humanities. We did just change our name from Cal Humanities because everybody thought we were the Humanities Department at Berkeley. And we got kind of tired of saying, no, we don't know whether that professor has room in his class for you. So, but the humanities have always been very central to my life. I'm a Southerner by birth, and so I really think storytelling is pretty much in my DNA. But I relish really being on the California Humanities Council because that's what we do. We are always talking about stories and connections. Recently, we just funded what I thought was a fascinating online exhibit called War Ink. And it was an exhibit that looked at the body art, the tattoos of young veterans. And by looking at their tattoos, you saw their emotional responses. You saw how they memorialized their fallen comrades. So this was obviously an emotional and a physical connection for them with these tattoos. And we need to understand that and hear it. So the images are so compelling that you really do want to listen longer and learn more. So listen longer, learn more. To me, that is the quintessential mark of the humanities. Now, the stories we hear from our grantees and the communities that we serve are not about the application process or any of that for our grants or of that kind of stuff, but it's really about the connections that they make in their communities, the relationships they form through the grants. We fund documentaries, we fund community stories, we fund books, we fund exhibits, we work with libraries, community centers, you name it. That's what we're here, is to tell stories and make connections. Darren Walker, who's the president of the Ford Foundation, recently gave a wonderful address when he was presenting the National Humanity Awards. By the way, Alice Walker, our beloved chef from around here, was one of those who recently got the Humanities Award. But he said that the humanities teach us that your story is our story. And I feel really strongly about that because we are alike. If you're from South San Francisco or you're from South America or you're from South Africa, we all have stories, and that's really what connects us and makes us want to listen to each other despite political boundaries or any kind of economic inequality. And he further goes on to say that he, and I quote now, despairs that our culture has brought into the notion that if something cannot be measured, it cannot matter, end of quote. And we are hearing, as Carolyn talked about, that some of the great universities are struggling with the fact that they have monetized their curriculum, that sometimes higher education is not about developing a more fulfilled and enlightened person. It's about forming a better paycheck. And economic inequality is certainly, in my opinion, a scissors that's ripping apart the social fabric. And so is the lack of time. That's a big obstacle to pursuing things that would really make you happy. So I decided to take a little different approach than my esteemed colleagues and do some hands-on research in my rural community about what did this subject mean about the humanities and the materialistic world. So I went out on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and I posed the questions that we were asked tonight to address. So I want to share with you, and excuse my notes on this, but I want to give these people credit, on some of the things that I heard back. From a prosperous business owner, a woman entrepreneur, she said, "We can always earn more money and buy more crap with it, but our time is finite." And for her, her mantra is a work-life balance. From a domestic worker, she said, "I don't remember the last time I had time to read a good book. I work two jobs trying to keep a roof over my kids' house and to make sure that they have the things that they need. I need the schools to make books and art and music important so that I can worry about having health insurance and being able to buy food." And from a very successful real estate broker, he said to me, we are a society that consumes stuff we don't need with money we don't have. It's pretty smart. In the 1950s, he went on to say, we managed this with one male head of household who supported the family. You know, dad went to work. In the 60s and 70s, women in greater numbers went to work to achieve the same. In the 80s and 90s, we started racking up incredible debt to do the same. And in his opinion, from the 20s to now, or the 2000s to now, we have zero interest rates, which allow us to keep buying to get to the same thing. And his final comment is, what's the next bunny we can pull out of the hat? From a musician, she wrote me that we have allowed the economic system to be based on a reward for human greed. There's no regulation and there's no control. We cannot change the culture without addressing this. Happy for her is music, good reads, and walks in the woods. That's what it's all about. And people really know this, she says, but we all get caught in that gotta-have world. And from a Head Start teacher, she said, we have luxuries on an everyday basis that are wildly beyond the dreams of any king or emperor. Yet we continue to feel alienated, unloved, and unfulfilled. I think, she said, we made a devil's bargain. We are using up everyone else's resources just so we can be comfortable. And from a union official, he said to me, materialism is for people who make money by not paying a living wage to people who work for them. Interestingly enough, that same day I heard on NPR that the owner of Chobani Yogurt had decided to give more than half of his personal fortune to support the refugees who are fleeing the horrendous wars in the Middle East, because he himself had been a refugee fleeing from his native land. Now, here's the part that you can only probably do in rural California without getting arrested. I actually stood in front of my Target store one day with my clipboard in hand, just to pose this question again. Out there in the real world with people I didn't know and they weren't responding to my, you know, digital posts or anything. And the answers I want to share with you. From a fast food worker, he said to me, it's all about time. When I have time with my kids and my friends, I'm the happiest person alive. I just need to make more money so I don't have to work more overtime, because then I don't have any time again. If I had time, I'd read a book and I'd go to concerts more. I'd hike with my kids. Nature is the bomb. And from a retired Caltrans worker, he said to me, and actually, George, you made reference to this, the quest to put as much time as possible between basic need and our long-term ability to provide for those needs is the driving force for the accumulation of wealth. If I have it, I don't have to work so hard. And so he thinks that the purpose of wealth is to allow time to feel that happiness. So I think back to what the fast food worker said to me. He didn't have enough time. And even if he worked overtime, he still didn't have enough time. I talked to a man who is a landscape worker. He said, we're prodded by industry to consume goods and services that make us happy. But we know that we've heard tons of stories about poor, happy people and unhappy, rich people. And that's been going on for a very long time, for at least the last 200 years, if not more, which is the time period we were kind of trying to take a look at. And from an attorney who said, what,
You're collecting from the Humane Society? I got my dog there. Let me write you a check. I had several people who wanted to give me money for the Humane Society. You know what? I got my dog from the Humane Society, too. I should have taken their money. But, you know, I think we've been raised with too many beautiful expectations, and we're absolutely terrified of failure. Being yourself and being a professional are often incompatible goals. A lot of times where we work doesn't care about what we do outside of working hours. And the laws that are supposedly designed to protect the workers and have, you know, more of a work-life balance, we have some of the weakest ones in the world. Just think about maternity leave and that kind of thing. That's continuing an issue. And it's alarming to me now that I think we are in a time where words cannot wait for thoughts. And first responses are often promoted as the best response. And patience can be seen as a liability. So economists now, in many cases, are the experts on happiness. Where wisdom once was, quantification now is. Quantification is the strongest influence, I believe, on the contemporary American knowledge of just about everything. If you can quantify it, it must be worth something. The distinction between knowledge and information is sometimes lost. So what's the difference? Human, humane, where you can get a dog. Humanities, humanism, humanitarianism. Actually, I like what Leon Wiestensteller wrote in the New York Times a few years ago. And I quote, "Here is the humanist proposition for the age of Google. The processing of information is not the highest aim to which the human spirit can aspire. The character of our society cannot be determined by engineers." With apologies to engineers. End of quote. So searches for keywords do not provide a context for those keywords. And patterns that are revealed in search engines or even by Siri herself will not identify their causes and origins. The new digital order does not relieve us of the responsibility to analyze, to interpret, and to show a preference. It's a tough life to be in the humanities when you think about it. I mean, there aren't a lot of jobs in the humanities, and they largely don't pay very well. But there's nothing soft about the quest for a significant life. It shouldn't be this way, but it is. You know, you can build it and get paid for it. You can finance it and get paid for it. But God forbid that you develop empathy for it. The humanities will question it, they will unsettle it, and they will seek a much deeper connection. Marcel Proust, one of my personal faves, said that the only true voyage of discovery, and I quote, is not to visit other lands, but to possess other eyes, to behold the universe through the eyes of another, of hundreds of others. To behold the hundred universes that each of them beholds. End of quote. You know, we're a storytelling and a musical people. We cannot stop our foot from tapping when there's a good beat, and our eyes will leave any task if somebody starts telling a good story or asks a really interesting question. And this, I think, is the central project for the humanities. Both for the museum I used to direct and for the California Humanities Council. And it's ultimately why I do think the humanities will prevail. We live in stories. We love learning about other people and their stories because that's how we find our commonality and that's how we learn to connect. We seek connections and we seek these paths to understanding. And for me, and I think for you all, the humanities is that compass. And even in this current environment, in the digital age, it still is a lot about storytelling. When you look at what's on Facebook or Instagram, what's on Twitter or Tumblr, it's people telling their stories. But there's also open mic nights and TED Talks and family reunions and cultural and community festivals about every nationality or ethnicity around the world. They're still sitting on your front steps talking, where I live. And I still, as a grandmother, enjoy telling those, well, when I was your age, stories that we used to hear. So we can see the stories of others, and in them we can find ourselves. We can find what we need to connect to be fulfilled. And it's something in finding our shared humanity that I believe will always triumph over materialism. It's been that way for the past 200 years and maybe even more. Thank you.
Just before we get to the questions, you mentioned this quantification idea, and in analyzing a different lecture we had here, what went wrong with 20th century physics, of all things? It was the basic assumption that if something cannot be measured, it cannot matter, or it cannot be known. It cannot be known is the way it's stated in physics. And a lot of errors in physics are created by that idea, because even when you're judging something from a material point of view, you need a context, you need a set of ideas that allows that what you measure to be put into context. Another thing that you said is another thing that came out plenty of times. I've heard said, time is the greatest luxury. You know, there's lots of luxuries to buy, but time is the greatest one. So I think it's a great example of exactly why it's interesting to have the humanities. I mean, I worked at a law firm in New York, lots of very smart people. The ones that were still passionate after 45 years of age all had some other interest in their life besides what they did for a profession. And I think the passion that was shown tonight is a very good example that that's true if you pursue something. So thank you very much. Now we have time for you to ask questions of our panel.
I would like to ask the musician on the panel about how his two different professions inform each other.
All right. Well, I set you up for that, I realize.
Yeah.
I've often wondered if the one makes me better than the other. And I think actually that it does, certainly from a practical standpoint. I have observed that people in the world of the arts don't always have a good business sense, don't always have the ability to approach the art as an enterprise. And here I would like to actually posit that it, in the 21st century, it needs to be an enterprise. That's really how the best way to pursue a performing career. You have to think of yourself as an agent, and nobody's going to ask you to perform. You actually have to be involved in promoting the group, promoting the enterprise. And then, of course, it's a managerial undertaking, and it's actually a significant managerial undertaking to have a trio that has a schedule and engagements and is doing education and teaching and commissioning composers and all of the rest of this. So I found that just the simple fact that I know how to run organizations, I manage armies of people in my other professional life, I know how to write copy. I know how to. I know how to make a website, and all of the rest of those things turns out to be extremely important. And it has certainly given the St. Michael Trio the ability to open doors and to develop a presence and to take that enterprising approach to what we're doing. So that's one. That's one thing. So then the question is, how does my artistic life inform my other professional life? I'm not honestly sure, but I will point out one thing. To be a great artist, you have to really care about details. You really do have to render every note. And there's a compact here implied. When you take the stage, you're going to play every note, and every note is going to be beautiful. And that that takes an intense amount of attention to detail and a level of perfectionism. Well, I've actually brought that ethic into my other life managing this organization. I tell my staff, we're not ever going to be sloppy. We're going to sweat every detail. That's going to be the hallmark of this organization. No detail is too small. And I think that's something that the art, the world of art, can actually bring to the other worlds. I'll leave it at that for now. There's other things that we can reflect on.
Yeah, thank you, George. Mm-hmm. I was here last week when we hosted Alva Noe, and he was presenting a similar discussion on how art can organize our lives and inform our perception of the world. At that night, this book wasn't available, but it is now. There's about 5 copies left, and Renee, the bookseller up on the second floor, has access to it. It's a wonderful read. I started and I'm well into it.
Thank you.
Oh, there are tons of starving artists out there. The California Humanities Council, we fund documentaries, we fund community stories, we fund books, lectures, as I said. We are funded primarily through the National Endowment for the Humanities. Each state has a Humanities Council, but then we also have do fundraising around the state to add to the amount of money we have available. This year in community stories or the documentary section, we probably had maybe 600 or 700 filmmakers contact us, and we'll fund maybe 100 of them. In community stories, the numbers are far greater. That might be over 1,000, and we can fund maybe 200 of them. We are kind of... I was explaining to Carolyn, we are sort of like the good housekeeping stamp of approval. So if you get a grant from Cal Humanities, it's a very rigorous process. It's very useful for you as a way to go on and leverage funds from somewhere else. Huge diversity. And I think one thing with organizations like ours and in academia, we have all these great pieces, but what I still think we kind of miss in a field is the grout that connects them. We got a great story over here about soldiers from World War II who were African American that takes place in Southern California base. And we fund that, and it's a great program. But how does that relate to other African American soldiers in other communities? Where's the commonality there? So this is what I think the challenge is now for the humanities, is to not only highlight the stories and engage in this storytelling and analyze it and think about it, but try to do a better job of being that grout that ties us together, not just as individuals, but as Californians as a whole.
Caroline, you're at Stanford, obviously one of the best liberal arts colleges in the country, along with a lot of other ones. That they also have seen a fall off in interest in the humanities. And do you know what the discussion is? I mean, I thought your historical perspective on the question, has this been discussed and everyone's saying, yeah, we can go back to this argument, or is it still, how are we ever going to get, you know, the funding back that we had before?
Well, so there's many answers to this terrific question, and let me assure you that we're constantly having this conversation at Stanford. You know, what are we doing for the humanities? Are students interested in the humanities? How can we get them more interested in the humanities? I actually believe that all students are interested in the humanities for exactly the reasons that you so eloquently laid out for us. These are the stories that tie us all together. What I do think, just to put a new conversation on the table as we move forward, is that the humanities are, in fact, insufficiently taught in the K through 12 part of the educational system. This is not to say that they are not well taught in K through 12. They are insufficiently taught. Most students, when they graduate from high school, have a very small exposure to the full range of humanistic inquiry. They will have taken American history, possibly European history, and they will have taken American literature, possibly British literature. Now, you can just tabulate in your head all of the wonderful things that are missing from that: philosophy, linguistics, art history, religious studies. And so what happens when these students arrive at the university is that they are hungry, but they do not know what to eat. And if we can begin to offer the humanities from the age of 4 forward, then we have hungry students who arrive at the university, but they know that now they have arrived at the biggest candy shop of all time. They have all of the humanities in front of them. So I think it's not just a matter of students being uninterested in the humanities. It's up to us as a society, through their teachers and through their parents, to light the fire. Even very, very small children can understand the value of humanistic inquiry. I love when I go to museums and I see a bunch of 5-year-olds there engaging in the way that a 5-year-old is able to engage with the art of another society. I think that's wonderful, and we should be doing that more. So this is a long answer to your question. Yes, we are having that conversation at Stanford. Yes, many other universities are having this conversation. Yes, it is good that we are having that conversation, but we need to also be having it with K through 12 education. Mm-hmm. It's of the highest national importance that we have this conversation.
Can I just follow up with that? Because I feel so strongly about it. The museum I used to direct is called Turtle Bay Exploration Park. And when we were designing it, we did an intercept study around to see what people felt about museums, and we learned within a 50-mile radius, 50% of the people had never been to a museum. So that was a little bit of a tough sell. But what we focused on right away was a family experience. And we found that literally when we had those 5-year-olds and younger into the museum for the first time, they'd never been in a museum. Their parents had never been in a museum. We had to teach them how to behave in a museum. No, you didn't take crayons and write on the wall. But now those same kids come back and tell us about all the museums that they go see on their vacations, because Turtle Bay, like many other museums, has a reciprocal membership with 250 other museums around the country. It gets them in free. So you're going somewhere, you look and see if there's a free museum there. But one other thing we also learned that's directly to Carolyn's point was we had some consultants come in from the Indianapolis Children's Museum. And they made me and other staff people walk around on our hands and knees going through the museum. Because they said, you've got to see what a little kid's seeing. Because if everything is up here and the grown-ups are the only one that can see it, that grown-up is never going to have a chance to enjoy themselves. There's got to be something down at this level for the small one to engage in, why the older one is also engaged. So it's that, and now we do have a donor who underwrites for every fourth grader in Shasta County a field trip to Turtle Bay, just for that very reason. So they get them in there, let them see it, let them be hungry because they've had a taste of it.
Thank you. Thank you all for your insights. I want more of that fire. And he's not the most popular person. Well, it's not universally popular, but David Brooks was touring about his book, and speaking about eulogy versus virtue versus career virtues. And I would add to that list coolness virtues, apt virtues, reductionist virtue, because it's become a virtue to get it down to three words. Mm-hmm. Your story. Your story's great. Can you say it a little faster?
Mm-hmm. Where the word comes before
and
the thoughts.
It's infuriating. And that fire, you know, when I was a kid, when I started college, my freshman year, I found philosophy and I fell in love. My father lived through the Depression, blah, blah, blah. He snuffed my philosophy fire and made me study business. And it's always stayed alive in me, and it's most often touched by music or by live performance. I don't know how. Words, numbers, none of it works. It's someone bringing me a story through music. But I don't know. I would love to help discover a wholesale solution. How do we... I know there's that hunger for the meaning. And Brooks talks about that too, how his students come to him hungry for meaning. But how do we wholesale change this perception that the almighty... It's not just the almighty dollar. It's the almighty success is just skewed to something that isn't wholesome. It's not those deeper connections. It's not that deeper meaning. The success is just this other plane that misses it.
This is a lovely question with potentially many answers, but I would offer one answer, which is that success should not always be measured by financial success. When you have accumulated your millions, what are you going to think about? What are you going to look at? And how are you going to fill the hours that your money has bought? And an education in the humanities, a humanistic approach to life, is, I think, really the ultimate goal beyond the material success, is the success in having a life in which you know what it is that you should be thinking about. That is real wisdom, I think.
I'm having a hard time, I guess, rectifying. So I'm an English teacher. I double majored in English and linguistics, but I teach in the Bayview, high school English. And while I definitely value the humanities, it's where my passion is, I think that it's a little... Not that I agree with this, but I do think it's a little bit indulgent to say, like, we should be, like, I'm thinking about my students, what's going to get them jobs, what's going to get them hired, these first-generation students who are not going to be making millions. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to survive. And so right now what our society values is not jobs in the humanities. And as someone who believes in the humanities and values it, I have a hard time directing my students, because as people who don't have any, you know, familial support or anything like that, what's going to put food on the table for them is not, you know, a degree in art necessarily. It's going into business. So if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, what is more important? What is the message I'm delivering to my students? So I think, I don't know, it just seems like, as much as I agree with you theoretically, it almost seems a little bit out of touch with a lot of what people are facing today.
I just agree with the premise. Mm-hmm. I lament. I have the same lament.
Mm-hmm. And I think when we talked about it earlier, it doesn't need to be your money-making element of life. It's an enhancer to your emotional life. And then there's, you know, it doesn't have to be a fight. In ancient times, a lot of philosophers said, you know, this life is a prison. This human life is a prison, and we're just trying to escape it. That's obviously very detrimental to everyone's idea about material life. It's not necessary at all to have it as an enemy, as was mentioned before.
The parallel.
Parallel, and one parallel
yes.
might not earn any money at all. They like to go out on Saturday nights, and it doesn't earn them any money at all. It's just for fun. So, you know, it's that kind of... It can be approached that way without any problem, I think.
Yeah, I sort of want to comment on what she said. I understand. I mean, people don't need to major in art history and get a degree in art history. But I think the humanities are important because they teach us how to think. And people need, no matter what kind of job they do, they need to be able to think so that they can get a better job and improve their life and raise their children and make decisions about who they're going to vote for. So the, you know, your students, they might need to be studying business or something like that, but everybody has to have some kind of exposure to this, or they're not going to be able to think, no matter what kind of job they do. I mean, it just, I think that's the argument for the humanities. You know, people aren't thinking these days, it seems to me. There's a lot of what you said, that word precedes the thought. There's a lot of action going on where people aren't really thinking things through. They don't think things through to the end, or they don't think about the context in which things are happening. And that's really important because we have a lot of problems in the world today, and people need to open up their minds.
I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the Common Core curriculum standards settle in, because they are designed to be more in the Socratic method of asking questions and getting students to think through things as opposed to just responding by rote. So I know it's been controversial in certain parts of the state, but for your reason alone, that's why I'm a fan of Common Core.
Well, I just wanted to second what the audience person just mentioned, that we need more examples of critical thinking. And it's for that reason that I would disagree with the emphasis of the California Council for many years now, that there's an emphasis, there's a kind of populist, democratic thrust of the California Council towards every man, every woman having insight. And that's just not the case. The humanities, the disciplines of the humanities, is an elitist, for to be frank, is an elitist exercise. It involves the excellence of the great writers, the great thinkers. And we seem to move away from that in the emphasis on democracy, that your opinion is as good as my opinion. And certainly in the general body politic, there's a renewed emphasis on your perspective is as good as mine. And we need to have a greater emphasis on the excellence. Now, you can't all go to Stanford, but I think the California Council could hold a few programs that, as Stanford does in their public programs, on the ideas, on the issues that involve philosophy, that involve great literature, and not just go to the lowest common denominator.
I just want to say I started college as a journalism major because I was so delighted that my father said he'd pay for my college education. I thought, well, I better be practical about this. But then at some point, the boyfriend I had at the time influenced me, and he was wise in steering me toward the study of literature. And it, you know, so I ended up with a minor in journalism. But I was so glad I went that route. Because it's true, there was an article, I think in the Chronicle a few years ago, about the virtues of getting a liberal arts education and the kind of jobs you get thereafter, that really it is about learning to be a critical thinker. And I have a nephew who's teaching in a public high school in Houston. It's a charter school, you know, gearing low-income students to toward college. But he says that he can barely be creative. It's all about testing. And I have a pediatrician friend of mine who thinks that one of the reasons why you have a lot of teenagers, especially having emotional problems, they get on Ritalin and they're geared towards prescribed drugs, is when they took out the music programs in schools. So what I'm asking is, you know, I'm sorry I forgot your name, the lady from Stanford who teaches and is on the board. Her history and all. What I'm saying is, could you please? I mean, you know, it worries me because Carrie Parlop, who directs the ACT here, was saying in a recent talk that she is astounded that, and well, sad that it's like 6% of Stanford students today will study, you know, anything from the classics, which is what she majored in, or anything, you know, in that general range. But it seems like most people are being geared towards careers, computer, you know, all this. I mean, not everybody can be in that field. I mean, so all I'm saying is I work in PR. I did all kinds of, with my English degree. So you're wrong. You know, a lot of times people will hire an English major because maybe they know this. Or you know, we think, okay, maybe she knows how to figure some things out. You know, let's give her a shot. So what I'm saying is, are you able to give influence to secondary education? Because it seems like it's desperately needed. Thank you.
Yeah, well, there's lots of different answers to your questions. One of the observations I'd make is that we have a lot of alumni who come back to Stanford in their 50s and 60s when they are the heads of companies and have been very, very successful in fields that we might imagine to be unrelated to the humanities, finance, et cetera. And they come to me at the Humanities Center, and they tell me with great excitement that they love to hire humanities majors, that this is who they look for exactly the reasons that all of you have reaffirmed tonight, is that the humanities prepare you for a variety of futures, and that one of the great gifts of the humanities, one of the skills that it develops is critical thinking, generalizable to a large variety of situations, on the job, off the job, etc. You know, it's complicated to be an adult, and it's nice to have the ability to think critically. We offer a new program at the Humanities Center, but it's part of a larger Stanford program that brings high school students who are interested in the humanities to Stanford, all expenses paid, if necessary, for 3 weeks of humanities. It's either boot camp or summer camp, depending on your perspective. They live in the dorms, and they are taught by tenured Stanford faculty. I teach in that program a course on the age of Thomas Jefferson. It culminates in a 10-page research paper using 18th-century sources in our library. When I look at what those students, their juniors and seniors, not only from around the country but from around the world, when I see what they are capable of, when I see what their teachers have already been capable of doing with them to form their minds as humanists, it gives me a lot of hope about the future of the humanities. They are they're not only hungry for humanism, they are ready for it. And the things that they tell us about their young lives, some of them are 15, they're extraordinary and moving, and they reaffirm that the technologies that we have today are not incompatible with humanistic inquiry. They develop along with it. One day we had an exercise about tweeting the things that Thomas Jefferson might have said.
That's great.
It was fantastic because it captured, so it was creative, they knew how to tweet, we had to learn, yes. But they knew how. But it captured that 18th century quality of wit, what is quick, what is, and that was very valued in the 18th century, and somehow a tweet captured that in a way that no amount of me standing up on the podium saying that they were witty in the 18th century in the following five ways would have done. So there are ways through this, and it is by bringing together the generations, teachers in universities, teachers in the primary and secondary system, young people themselves, and asking them, the way you asked people outside of Target, what's on your mind? What
and
are you
didn't
thinking?
Get arrested. Yeah.
And you didn't get arrested. You got some contributions. This is how we will solve the problem. So forums like this one are perfect because they get us all stirring the air around this incredibly important issue that is not just a question for schools. It's a question for the nation to address.
I think some of you are probably aware of this, but I thought it was fascinating that the Mount Sinai Medical School in New York, which is a very prestigious medical school, has developed a whole program to recruit humanities students. because they realize that organic chemistry does not a good doctor make. And they're absolutely going out after humanities students to come to med school.
Well, how about the change from STEM to STEAM?
Yeah, yes. That's huge realization, I think, of exactly what Carolyn is saying.
Great. We have time for one more question.
Well, thank you for being here and for your insights. I have one question. For me, many of the subjects of humanities are subjects of lifelong learning. And if you have to balance material as well as moral interests or concerns in today's world, perhaps one possible way is to make it easier to learn these throughout one's life. And so my question is, perhaps technology is a way to help with that. And how do you see, for example, online learning and making you know, great content accessible or access to other people through community, maybe create using technology for your advantage to improve the teaching humanities from a student's perspective? How can technology be used to enhance that experience?
So, as you can imagine, we have this conversation a lot at Stanford as well. We have a lot of conversations at Stanford about humanities and the digital world. So the great thing about digitization is that it has brought us a revolution that is akin to Gutenberg, the invention of the printing press over 600 years ago. And this is that the whole corpus of the human experience, from Neolithic bones to the thing you wrote down yesterday, is being digitized. And it is not all behind a paid wall of access. So that there are people around the world who have access to humanistic knowledge, to documents, to art, to music, in a way that even 10 years ago was not possible. So at the sort of most basic level of your question, technology and the humanities and arts are walking hand in hand into the future, and there is an enormous potential for democratization of the human experience. However, the best way to teach is still close contact in small classrooms with students. That teaching is, and I mean this in the best possible way, teaching is inefficient and labor-intensive. It must be that way because human minds are chaotic and unpredictable. And so we need to find ways to combine the enormous globe-spanning democratic potential of the digitization of the whole human experience with the very real fact that the small classroom setting with an engaged teacher or teachers and a small group of students who are held accountable for learning, we need to reckon with those two poles and how to bring them together. And I think that's the challenge for the next 5 years.
That's great. And in addition, I think we just kind of take a look at it and say, you know, nothing, I was about to say the last thing too, nothing replaces human contact. That's what humanities is all about. And that's why live theater will always exist, why live performances will always exist, no matter how good the TVs get, no matter how 3D they get, whether we have holograms in our living room, people are still going to go and see a live performance mind to mind, and that will never change. So, as I said, there's no fight going on here. There's new tools. The material world success should give us tools to be more humane, no question. We just have to remember that's what we're up to. So, thank you very, very much, everyone. And so ends another discussion at the Commonwealth Club in its 112 years of history.